Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Riff Hard Podcast. Hey, I love it here. My guests today are good friends of mine who are returning to the podcast, Mr. Ricky Armellino and Chris Kelly. Ricky is known for being a guitar player in the band Ice Nine Kills and also a really great producer and songwriter. Chris Kelly is a former touring guitar player for Ice Nine Kills, touring guitar player for another really big band that I can't mention, and just one of the most talented people I know in the industry. Also a really, really good studio engineer, good vocalist, do it all. But they have a new band called Hill Haven, which is debuting right about now. So figured, why not bring them back on? And let's do it.
For anyone who's listening right now, you're probably not going to get all of the B-roll of us eating chicken and trying to figure out Zoom, but that's, man, it's a shame. You should get that. That's in its own episode.
Hell Haven.
Yeah, Hell Haven.
I mean, I know it's Hill Haven, but Hell Haven.
I've had a couple people.
Is there still time to change it to that?
No.
Okay. Yeah, it's not going to be that, yeah. It's not going to be that.
So how do you guys have time to do a new band?
We don't. We're just doing it anyway.
You can literally see how hurt I am in the videos. I'm like recovering from an injury over here, and I think we're just kind of overachievers, and we have to be doing something all the time. So
we're just so awesome.
Yeah. Just it's just the
we just can't stop being awesome.
Just can't stop winning.
No, but for real, like I mean, for me, I had to ask myself the same thing when restarting the band. One of the reasons I didn't start playing for a long time, because I thought about it a few times, was like, I know what's going to happen. It's going to be casual for like 2 weeks, and then the psychotic thing is going to kick in, and then it's going to get serious, and then we're going to get signed again, and it's just going to, I know what's going to happen, and it's going to take over my life. Do I really want this? And so,
do I want to ruin everything again?
Yeah,
you're like,
exactly.
You're like looking at that, you're like,
things are going so well. Like, I want to fuck up? But like, I guess the question is not why do you want to fuck up your lives, because you already did. You guys play music for a living, but
yeah.
But why would you want to fuck it up even more?
We can't say who you play for, right?
You can. I'm pretty sure you can put it in the description, and no one will care.
Yeah. But so
I'm
we're
not
a prominent band from Japan.
Prominent band.
I'm not supposed to say. You can Google.
Okay. Yeah.
Google it.
Do the math. So, but I think there's something about being a project like that where, your attention starts moving away from just like the music side of things. Where you're like, when you're young and you start a band, what do? You obsess over the music, and you're just like, music, the music, the music. And then once you've been touring for a while, then all of a sudden you find out, you're like, wait, there are like hundreds of things that I can obsess over. And that starts looking really appealing, because you look at the stage show. Where do the lights go? You know, how's the marketing rollout going to be? What are the videos going to look like? How are the photos going to be? What kind of resentfulness am I going to desire out of my texts? You know what I mean? And then you just want to try it again.
In all seriousness, he did touch on something that that I didn't think about the last time that we tried talking about this. Like he said, when you start out, like when you start playing music as a kid and you start a band, like your idea of what success is going to be is very narrow. Typically, right? It's like, I'm going to start a band. My band is going to get signed, and that is going to be my life, right? And for a lot of us, that's not how it goes. And we get to look ourselves in the mirror every day and go, your band didn't make it. That's why you're here.
move to your left just a little. Do you really look in the mirror and say that?
We have before, actually, during when I was out with 1-9, we did
one of the fun. That was a funny week when we just started talking into the mirror in front of everybody in the dressing room, and Joe said the funniest one. Like, we were like, there was hard laughter, like the laughter of like men who just heard like a hard truth and have no other way of processing it. Joe just looks in the mirror and goes, "You're only here because nothing else worked out." Now you have to do this.
Yeah, so like I said, you have a very narrow idea of what success is going to look like when you're starting out. And then your focus shifts. At some point, like for me, the trajectory was, you know, my own shit and then Galactic and then the band that I play for now and Ice Nine kind of swapping back and forth. And within those different jobs, it was like, okay, well, you know, maybe now I can learn about, like, with Galactic, I was doing a lot of, like, tour managing stuff. So it's like, I can try to learn about the touring and the focus on the business side of that. And then with Ice Nine and my current gig, it was like, okay, well, this is, you know, I'm not contributing to this creatively. So it's my chance to really just focus on, like, my ability as a player, right? And at a certain point, at least for me, along the way, what your job just becomes a job, you know, like, still really grateful for the position that I find myself in. Not a lot of people get to do this, but like, you just start looking at it like work. But like, you kind of look at it the same way in certain cases as like somebody who's going to work a 9-to-5 is just like, oh, you know, all right, packing up, going to Japan again, whatever it is, like, which is a crazy thing to get jaded about.
I've never been to Japan.
It's definitely a top three.
It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's great.
I want to see it so bad.
But so all this being said, like, eventually I just kind of hit a point where I kind of had to, like, figure out why I still liked this, if that makes sense. Like,
yep.
Because I just got so used to it that it just became really easy to complain about stuff. And I realized within that process that, like, I had kind of lost the creative side. You know, AL, you know about my other band, Illustrium, that I've had forever. Like, we, you know, we hadn't done anything with that for a number of months, like, or no, over a year.
Which
by
is
that point
sick, in. By the way.
Oh, yeah, Illustrium's great.
Yeah.
Thank you. But yeah, it was just like, I found myself missing that part of the process, right? I got really caught up in, like, the size of the shows and, like, you know, kind of the quote-unquote status of the whole thing, kind of lost the creative love for a little bit. And so when I started working on the music that would eventually become Hillhaven, that's what really kind of fueled everything. Was just like, I'm actually doing something creative again. And in this context, it was like, I kind of don't have any outside voices, meaning like voices that I don't trust, right? Like, I would send ideas to these guys back and forth, and like, if they would give me feedback, I could trust that. And like, it was actually like welcomed. I didn't have any like shitheads in the band to don't know what they're talking about, like you do when you're young, right? So it just kind of reignited that love for music that I sort of felt like I lost a little bit. And I think that's your question about having time or finding time or whatever, that's been the motivation primarily. I think it's just like, I'm really fortunate to have Ricky and a good group of dudes who actually know what they're doing involved in this, and I think we're all kind of stoked on the material. And the fact that we now have like videos shot and we're like a week away from launching the band is like you were saying about Doth, where it's just like at some point you're like, oh, it's actually happening now. And, you know, now we're going to have to figure out what that's going to look like. But for now, you know, we're just enjoying the process.
Yeah.
I mean, really, well, do you mind moving your left just an inch?
Again?
Yes. You keep scooting. I know you love Ricky, but
I don't mean to scoot.
You keep on scooting. But, like, a few things is, at the end of the day, if you look at something like the totality of a project, is like everything you're going to have to do, it's easy to get overwhelmed. But in reality, how many of those challenges do you have to deal with all at the same time? Usually it's just like you've got the thing you got to deal with now. I think that if you take a rational approach to getting things done, it's easy to make it work even with a busy schedule. But with in regards to what you were saying about definition of success changing, like I remember when I was growing up in my teen years, I'd watch like bands, like huge bands, like the same bands we all looked at. And that was my definition of success. And then when I got a little bit older, I would meet people who would tell me that there's a bunch of different things you can do in music and have a great life still. And that's not losing. And I thought they were full of shit. I didn't want to hear a fucking word they had to say about any of it. Like, but then
this
I got
just
even
some
a little
idiot
bit older
who didn't make it.
I realized they were right.
Yeah.
They're 100% right, actually.
Right. Yeah.
But
yeah, for me, I actually, one of my big like life changing moments was first tour I did with Ice Nine Kills. When I was there, I was watching Motionless and White. And they had like 13 people from Pennsylvania on payroll. You know what I mean? I just never, because I'd never toured in a band that actually put me on tour with a band that had a crew like that before. And the first time that I saw that that was an option, where you're like, wait, I can make opportunities for like my homies. Like, you know what I mean? Like that was just so far to me. I never thought about that concept before, that I could actually do stuff that affected the lives of just like the people around me. You know what I mean? Because to me, touring in a band was just like, just a scourge on my life for a long time. It was just like, we're going to go in this van. Everybody's going to lose money. We're going to be gone for 2 months. We're going to come back. We're going to be in a deep hole. We're going to figure it out. Let's go, guys. And there's only a certain number of times that you can convince your best friends to do this before, you know, I think it's like a, it sums up to an act of hatred, although like well-intentioned, you know what I mean?
I was there for the last.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's all that. But you know, what basically ended up happening was, I went on my first tour where I'm seeing there's a guitar tech and there's a drum tech and there is, you know, a video guy and a photo guy, and there is a tour manager and there is an assistant tour manager and there is a merch guy and there's a stage manager and there is a stage actor one, stage actor two, and there's a makeup person and there's wardrobe, and all these people are getting paid this is their job. And it was like the first time that I saw like being a musician might be less selfish than I always kind of felt it was, because when I had moved out of touring for like 5 years, that was one thought that I had, was like, I got to stop being a dick to my friends and making them do this. This is selfish. And then you go out, you see there's a group of guys, nice as ever, Motionless and White. They're from, you know, Pennsylvania, where I'm from.
Salt of the earth.
Yeah.
Single person on that crew.
I love them so much. But, it, you know, and I saw that and I wanted that for myself. And it was a matter of like, well, now I'm going to have to get good at this shit. And that was frustrating.
No more sucking.
Yeah, no more sucking. I like that.
As of today.
As far as I can tell, looking through those old videos, I loved it. I loved sucking.
You know what? That is something that people don't realize about successful bands, is that it creates this little economy around them. And the bigger the band is, the further that reaches. Like, so for instance, if you have a Metallica or something, which I know you guys are familiar with, is the success of Metallica basically spreads out to a lot of people. They have a whole industry that's just like their thing. But then every band that they take on the road, like every person at the merch company, like the people at their label, like just there's so many people.
I don't have the hard numbers, but I think it's safe to say that like Metallica as an entity has a more thriving economy than like several countries.
Well, it's interesting because so, you know, Ice Nine Kills has been doing these, you know, these Metallica dates, and the shows are, you know, there's like a 2 week gap in between every show. And you go and you look at the stage show that they're putting on and you get it. There's like 8 giant video towers. There's this giant, you know, circular stage in a football stadium. Like, it's taking time to put this together in every area. And they're playing, you know, several shows at these venues. But what you don't think about is in that time in between, you know, all the other bands are, they need to go play shows as they normally do. They need to, you know, keep the wheels moving. And
juggling those two things has got to be insane.
Well, so when we did a couple shows with Lamb of God, because Pantera is also doing these Metallica shows, and you see that there's actually a secondary economy being created, because bands like Ice Nine Kills and Five Finger Death Punch and Pantera, they're making their own tours in between the Metallica dates. And then there are bands on those tours who need to go find other shows to play when the headline band breaks off and goes and plays with Metallica. And sometimes they have to go kind of far. There's a couple days. So there's like three layers of touring that happen. And then there are like bands that are playing out at these like small shows out in the parking lot for the audience, which I think is really cool. There were like some really cool ones on those shows. And then they're traveling out and they're like playing a few festivals on the way. So there's this like weird tapestry of like, you know, at different layers of, you know, the Metallica economy that was happening. And it was really interesting because, you know, we ended up playing a couple shows with Acacia Strain and they were like, oh yeah, well, we're on tour right now with Lamb of God, because Lamb of God's on tour with Pantera and Pantera's out with Metallica like you guys. And yeah, you're kind of like, oh wow, that's, you know, that was all.
But yes, and then
that's all.
If you factor in that every single one of those bands is employing people.
Yeah. 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 I think that creatively the best thing you can do for yourself is to have a couple people who depend on you, because when you're working on, you know, music and everything, to me, it was always just this really selfish thing. You know, I write these lyrics that I'm going to really,
me,
you know, I'm going to really make a big impression. So I was big on shock stuff. Like, I really like the idea of shocking people, like, whoa, that guy would say that. And I don't know why, because now when I'm working on songs, there are considerations to make. There are the other guys. They're, you know, like our merch person even gets like factored into that discussion. Like, is this representative of all of us? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, because I mean, if you make one misstep, however minor, like you piss a couple of people off, and then the next time they're at a merch table, they're going to be grilling your merch person. Yeah. Why do you associate with these guys when they sang about this? You know what I mean? Like, yeah,
I'm pretty good at staying away from those topics. I just mean more general.
Everything trickles down.
Yeah,
everything
yeah.
trickles down. It's really easy, I think, to forget like how small the business is, like the industry in general. Like, because when you're in it, it feels so massive, especially when you're doing, you know, I had the opportunity to do a couple of the Metallica dates when I was still playing with Ice Nine. And like, when you're in that environment, it seems so like unfathomable, like larger than life. Like, how does all the logistics around this possibly work? There's so many people, you know, when you're used to the level of touring where like you see every member of every band every day. Whereas like when you're touring with a band like Metallica, you don't see them most of the time. You know what I mean? Like,
we do now.
Yeah.
And now you do, but it took a while. You know what I mean? Like, when we did those shows when I was doing it, like we
I think there was a reason for that. And I think that
those COVID stuff?
No. Oh, well, it could have been, but I think those shows were just a lot more hectic. Because I think they were flying in for those. There wasn't like this giant stage show. So the guys are in town for a few days before everything happens.
That's
so
true.
At these arena shows, they really do kind of come just to be at the show. Like, they've been watching all of the artists. They always talk to all of us. Like, we chat about the show and they'll be like, oh, I saw that you were doing this. That was really cool. There's something that's so crazy about getting a chance to know those guys and become friends with them, because there is no distinction between them and like just a band that you would be on tour with. They want to chat about what guitars you like to play and like, oh yeah, I used to have one of those. And then they want to chat about new bands that they found. They want to chat about how everybody's set went. I've never once felt like out of my element having a conversation with one of them, because they always go way out of their way to make sure they're like, hey, I really appreciate you being here. You guys like really helped us out a lot by being on this tour, and I'd love to get a chance to know you. And it's never been anything shy of that once. And it's like, God, and that's another life-changing moment, because it's like, God damn, even if I got that successful, I could be that cool to everybody. Like, that's okay. You know what I mean? Like, that's great.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people think that, you know, rock stars like can be people.
Oh my God, they're awesome. So it's that's been really exciting.
Yeah.
It's wild. How long did it take before the surreal nature of it wore off and it was like, all right, they're acting like normal people, I'll act like a normal person too, and we'll just chill.
You know, there's like like the marble going in the hole game.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the in this situation, the metaphor is depression. Sometimes depression works out, but I was actually having a really tough time with the amount that we were touring early on. And I just remember it was like, I think the second show we played with them, I had a pretty, you know, it was like a 10-minute conversation with Hetfield. And I remember calling somebody I was close to, and I was kind of crushed because I was just like, I'm in such a bad state. I wanted it to feel like something. And it was like how, you know, how much of a toll all the touring was taking on me. And it started becoming surreal afterwards. So there was this period of time that I think like I just couldn't kick into gear. None of it, nothing. I could have met Barack Obama and it would have, you know, just been like, yeah, I mean, it's weird. He was just a guy, you know what I mean? Like I didn't, he wasn't glowing. There wasn't, you know what I mean? There wasn't like,
didn't start playing.
I didn't get shot with a silencer. Like, I don't know. It's just, but it was.
That's
it
the Clintons.
Was, yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah. So there was like, I kicked it, you know, like I had to do a lot of work to get out of that spot. And it was like the one time we were in the dressing room and I needed to get something from my TM's office. And it was like way down these arenas. Like I'm starting to, you know, get like kind of a idea of the layout. You just walk around a giant.
It's just a circle. It's just a fine circle. Yeah.
So I'm like walking.
Yeah,
for
it's
like
just a ring.
Yeah, it's like I walk for like 15 fucking minutes. And I finally.
It's the worst when you go the wrong way.
Oh my God. I finally. I get to her door. It's super late and I'm tired and I'm trying to communicate with her about something. And one of the guys from Metallica was getting my attention. And then I like turn and they're all getting ready to perform. And I got a chance to just hang out with them for a little while they're, you know, like they have a bunch of friends around and they're just, you know, kind of doing the stretches and getting ready. Mm-hmm. And everybody's just chatting. And I accidentally ended up in their warm-up party. Like, I even ended up in the, like, let's go, hand out, you know, let's do this. And that was when it was just like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. You know what I mean? Because it's crazy. And it was like, finally, I saw it through a context of being like, am I schizophrenic? am I just schizophrenic? Is any of this actually happening?
I think I'll be like,
I don't know.
Yeah, jury's out.
yeah, jury's out. That's a whole other fucking box to unpack, and there's a lot of tape on that.
Oh, but I mean, I think, like, a lot of what you were saying about how it took you a while to, like, kind of snap out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of goes back to what we were talking about, how, like, easy it is to get jaded in this business. Like, it's, like, nothing. I mean, now, I only did 3 of those shows before I went back to my gig, and they were, where was it? Vegas, Pittsburgh, Buffalo. Vegas was the first one. That was several months before the other two. And that one was like, holy shit, like, I can't believe we're here.
Yeah.
Buffalo, like, no joke. I walked into the stadium at Buffalo like, all right, cool, we're at work again. Like, such a piece of shit, dude. Like, I like not even like, oh, yeah, like, this is just what I do. I play stadiums. Like just instantly, like, I'm at work.
I understand.
Yeah, you know, I'm at work, like, whatever, and so
I think it's because the sun was in our eyes.
Well, okay, so real quick, I have had this conversation with people where they're like, dude, that must have been so insane to play with Metallica. Like, what was that like? And I go, the experience was really cool. It's really great to say that I did it. I got a lot of really good Instagram photos out of it. The show itself was a bit difficult, like, because when you're playing in a stadium as the opener, you're going on at like 5 p.m. and those stages are pretty much always designed to face directly into the sunset. Like, so like,
you're just like, you're like playing Where is Waldo, being like, I think there are people out there. Right, I think there's,
I couldn't fucking see. I'm pretty sure I got sunburned the first show.
I'll tell you, okay. So I'll tell you one thing. I'll tell you one thing I learned about myself. Because I'm a pretty disciplined person when it comes to eating, when it comes to like, I try to eat healthy. And that's something I identify with. And then those shows, I will say the catering is pretty wild. And the dessert table has been pretty wild. And you can just keep fucking taking stuff. And as I was like trying 6 desserts one day, I realized I was never actually that disciplined. I'm just really good at turning down bullshit.
Yeah,
but like,
I mean, but only that one day though, right?
Yeah. Only,
yeah.
And every other event that we
play.
It's a really good trait. And this is, I think that lots of listeners are not going to be able to identify with this. And I'm sorry, but it's a really good trait, in my opinion, to be able to, you know, something really awesome happens, like the Metallica show or like with Riff Hard, us doing the Zach course or whatever. Like, I remember when Dot did Ozfest, like, just that kind of stuff. That's just like, holy shit.
Never thought you'd get there.
Yeah.
And it's happening.
And then you are. Yeah. And you got to, like, not fuck it up. That being able to, I guess, downgrade it to just a normal life is what will keep you from fucking it up. If you're sitting there like, wow, this is insane. The whole time, you're going to get in your own head and you're going to fuck it up.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to keep it cool. And a lot of people are like, you got to take time to appreciate things. It's like, yeah, I understand why you're saying that, but
I'm
just trying to not fuck it up.
Yeah, no. I'm always like, when somebody's like, you got to take time for yourself, I'm like, okay, what the fuck does that mean? Because everybody keeps saying that. And I watch TV for half an hour and just get eaten away at by anxiety, being like, you really should be getting shit done. And it's like, that's not fun. And then you try going on vacation and then you're like, no, I can't work. This is awful.
Yeah, I'm convinced that taking time for oneself and like live it and the feeling that you're living your best life is a fucking myth that Instagram has been pushing. Because like, even when things are going really well in any context of my life, wherever I am, I'm always stressed.
I love this image of Chris just on a beach, stressed out.
Like, I won't go to the beach. I won't do a vacation like that. Like, if I do a vacation, if I go on vacation, it has to be somewhere where like I'm moving constantly.
Ski resort.
Fuck that. No.
Ski resort.
I mean, technically, you are moving the whole time.
Yeah.
But from the same place to the same place.
But
you are moving.
Like hiking or like fucking just being a tourist, like going out and seeing the sights or taking my kids to Disney World, right? You never get to fucking sit down at Disney World. It's just got to be something where I don't get to think about the fact that I'm not working.
He sends his kid down the zip line and then he doesn't go. All right, guys, have a great life.
This is predates Instagram, though.
That's
I've been hearing that
going out for a pack
since,
of smoke.
Since I was in high school. Like, when I learned in high school to just stop talking to people about my goals, because it's going to make them hate me or they're just not going to get it and we're going to have a disconnect. So it's better
to get negative,
not talk
way
about this stuff. Because the moment I would start talking about what I wanted to do, that kind of stuff would start coming out of people's mouths. Like, you just got to take time for yourself, or like, why do you need all of that? Like, can't you be happy with this? And like, you should just appreciate things more, et cetera. It's just like,
I appreciate it.
You can say
it
that
by
when
working.
You don't want those things.
Yeah. Well, you appreciate it by working, by putting in the time, you know?
Right. You show some respect for the work that you've put in by putting more work in.
Okay. But realistically, you do.
It's true, though.
So, you know, we touched on like the mental health thing. I mean, it's for any, like, my ENT referred to my job as a high excitement occupation. Basically,
and after all, an ENT is a mental health
professional. No. Well, that we're talking about the loud noise. Because I actually I found out this year my hearing damage isn't nearly as bad as I thought it was. And but my so I had a scary scary incident happened where I just woke up one day and my tinnitus was loud. It was louder than it had ever been. It was competing with quiet conversation. So on one hand, I started working on ASL more, like actually in earnest, as to where before I was just learning how to say like, try me, bitch, and funny stuff. And, I had an appointment with my ENT and I talked to him about it. And I was like, hey, my tinnitus is getting really bad. And 5 years before, I was told by an audiologist after a test that I had moderate to severe hearing damage. And then they spent months trying to sell me $9,000 hearing aids. You cannot get health insurance to help on those. So that's just a no, you know, for a musician being like that. No, I'm not spending $9,000 on something. That's insane.
And that's what it feels like buying in-ears.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, there's no program for this?
Yeah. So that had happened like 5-6 years ago, man. And so I went to an ENT and then we did the test and I was scared as hell because my tinnitus was loud. I knew they were going to tell me something that was going to really, really be hard to listen to. And you know, you get ready to go, you know, have that out of body disassociative thing happen. And then they're like, I did the test and they're like, yeah, your hearing's fine. And it was like, wait, what? And they're like, yeah, mild hearing damage, anything you'd expect out of a, like an, you know, exciting environment career. And then I found out that the audiologist I went to was well known to lie to people to try to sell in-ears, or not in-ears.
He's sell in-ears.
Yeah, sell in-ears. So
he was an agent for JH.
But, you know, so that being said, you know, there's like always a lot of, there's a lot of health, you know, like physical things you're doing yourself. There's a lot of emotional things you're doing to yourself because you're pulling yourself away from your whole, your whole support network. They're looking at your life like you are having fun 10 hours a day. You don't see it like that. You know what I mean? Like, I have to have that conversation normally. They're like, oh, I see your Instagram. You're having a good time out there.
Dude, Instagram is a highlight reel.
Yeah.
Anyone who's having this thought of like, oh, that guy's life rules, Instagram is a highlight reel.
But I mean, like, you know, I still enjoy it. I still respect it. It's just
highly curated highlight reel.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You find a way to make it look good. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you like, there's shit. You get to an age where you got to do some repairing. And that whole time for yourself thing has come up with like mindfulness, meditation, you know, running, working out, you know. I have to force myself to have times in the day where I take 10 really deep breaths. I put myself in a better nervous system state, and then I try to go maintain it while doing things that are going to pull me away from these like thoughts. Like, am I good at what I do? Do people appreciate what I do? Am I, you know, doing things that are benefiting all the people around me who work with me or for me or any of that stuff? Like, it's a cloud of that all the time until I can get that like 2 hours a day where I can just like clean that out. And unfortunately, you know, for entertainers and musicians, getting out of that cloud takes months of effort if it gets really thick, I think.
I think that's what people mean though when they say take time for yourself.
Really?
I think they're just talking out their ass and don't know what they mean.
Yeah, they're just like, reduce
your expectations or something, or like, Don't make me feel bad by telling me something cool you're doing. They don't mean actually get your mental health in check.
Oh, that's not what they were saying?
No, I don't think so. I think that's...
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Ricky gives everyone the benefit of the doubt. It's a very redeeming quality.
There's a reason I don't think so. It's because the same thing that we were just saying, that most people think that you're out there partying 10 hours a day. Why would they think that you need to get your mental health in check if you're just partying all day and having a fun time the whole time? So they don't really understand what you do. So I don't think that their advice really counts, because it's not coming from a place of any sort of understanding. They're just telling you to like not make them feel bad when you show them cool shit that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really,
in my opinion.
There's a really big emphasis on communication when you have a job like this. And when I say communication, I mean like within your like close circle, you know, your family, your, you know, your anyone close to you, your loved ones, whatever, like, because they are also like, you know, we're talking about people who think your, you know, your life is awesome and you're just out there partying and it's always a good time and whatever. Like, we're generally talking about strangers, but your family will think that too, you know? Yeah. So like in my experience, it's just so crucially important. I think probably a little bit more so than maybe a normal job to like try to be on the same page as like your spouse or the other people, like, so they know what's happening and that they're like confident in everything that's going on or whatever. Cause like, it's really easy. Like, yeah, it's one thing for some, like your, you know, your friend or somebody that, you know, that you used to work with or went to school with, or just a stranger who just feels bad about their life and saying things like, oh, you just need to take some time for yourself. Why are you doing all this kind of stuff? But like, those conversations get real heavy when it's actually close to home.
Well, I will say something. I feel like I was actually, this is a conversation I was literally having this morning with somebody who I'm very close with, who's kind of dealing with similar conversations. Somebody that they're really close to is accusing them of not spending enough time doing specific things before they go out for a long time on tour and have a lot of fun. And for them, they're frustrated. We're talking about, because, you know, he was saying, I'm frustrated because I'm not going to be having that much fun. It's work. And, you know, I'm being accused of not spending my time home correctly because of this impending fun. And for me, I you know, that kind of stopped, I think, when I hit like 30, because I think there's this thing that sort of happens that you have to like almost prove to all of the people in your life that you're about it. You know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of people, like, there's like this like little thing underneath that conversation where they're like, hey, you know, clock's ticking. You're going to need to figure it out and become a foreman or some shit. You know what I mean? Like, there's usually an assumption that you're not going to be doing this for the long haul.
It's a phase.
Yeah.
The assumption.
And once you get through that, and I think then there kind of starts this new relationship with some of the people in your life where all of the sudden they start kind of like trying to figure out what it is you do. And they're just like, okay, let's, you know, let's reshape this relationship. So what do you do? You know what I mean? And like, and that's an opportunity to bring them in closer and, you know, try to, you know, get your people on your side. You know,
I think I probably speak for a number of us when I say that one of the biggest achievements in life is when members of your family at Thanksgiving stop saying things like, how was your trip?
You know? How's it? How's your little band?
Yeah.
Your little group. Your little group. Your little group.
Still doing that? Why is the singer so angry?
I had a relative, not immediate, but a relative, did the whole don't quit your day job when he heard one of the songs I recorded when I was 15. And I always think back on that. I was like, bitch, I was 15. Right.
What
you
day
expecting?
Job? Like, yeah. School? Like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What an asshole.
That was a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
That was really cool. That was really cool of them.
Dude, a child. Fuck you.
Yeah, so like that person you were talking to, I understand, even though I don't know the details, like I understand that whole conversation. But what I've learned as I've gotten older is that generally when I have felt like that about a specific person, it's generally my fault. It not always, but generally it's my fault for not communicating well enough and just assuming that they should just get it. Like, just like, why don't they just fucking get it? Like, it's so obvious.
Yeah. 100%.
Like, I'm in my, I live this life 24/7. Why aren't they living through my head or something? Like, it's just this weird, disconnected from reality.
It's so
thought.
Important. Yeah.
Well, it's like a subversive thing with, especially when like people like me, I tend to look down on you know, the way I do things or the quality of the things that I do.
I thought you were about to like list a group of people.
Me too.
I was like, we're about to learn something.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought so too.
Yeah. I'm like, ah, shit, we're going to have to edit this one. No. I typically looked at, you know, it's just a way of thinking. Some people look up to the things that they do and some people look down on them. And when you're in the mindset where you are very frequently assuming that the person you're talking to is just better than you in a lot of ways, you get confused when they don't understand something that you think's easy to understand. It's like, hey, I'm working under the assumption that you're much smarter and much more capable than me. Why don't you get this? And there's like this confusion that's going on. And that's something I've experienced before.
Yeah. And also I've noticed that just because I told somebody something doesn't mean that they got it. Or like, I need to verify that that we're on the same page. And yeah, I'm talking about stuff like this. Like, even when I wasn't touring, and when I would say the first 5 years of Nail a Mix, when I would go on those trips every single month, like I did that for 5 years straight, like every single month, a Nail the Mix trip, sometimes more. And
there was
someone in my life at that time who did think that I was just going off on these like, crazy music trips and like fucking partying and doing like wild entrepreneur stuff and like meeting, like also with like my musician friends and like just living this life that I wasn't living at all. Like these
they assume you were fucking, like Mark Cuban or something. Like,
yeah, like some crazy shit. Totally crazy shit. When like in reality, the Nail the Mix trips are like a tour. Like they're like a 5-day tour where you're traveling with a bunch of gear. You're like doing music stuff the whole time. You're with the same people. Like you're not really interfacing with outside people.
And I was there for one of them a long time ago, and I'm not
at the old atrium spot. I was at that.
Oh yeah, you were in the spot. I was at one another one. We're not going to talk about which one.
I know. Because
I was hanging out with all you guys, waiting for files to load onto a hard drive so I'd never have to go back there. And it was like the shittiest version of Mission Impossible.
I was sitting here wondering which place you were talking about. As soon as you said, so I didn't have to go back there, I was like, I know exactly what he's talking about.
As do I.
Yeah.
That one was rough. But, you know, even the ones that aren't rough is still like, there was this one stretch where in the span of like 2 weeks, like we did the URM Summit in Vegas, which was like 5 or 7 days of just like non-fucking stop doing this thing. Then immediately went to Denmark. Like the next day went to Denmark and did this thing for 3 days with Tui Madsen. And it was like, it was literally
Madsen
like
rules.
Go finish in Vegas, go to Denmark, like before you can even catch your breath. Then we went to LA and we did another Nail the Mix that with Jens, and then immediately went to Putney's place like 2 days later and shot like a 3-week course with him. It was just like that kind of stuff. It reminded me a lot of touring because it's like you don't have the time to get adjusted to anything. And there's constantly problems that you have to improvise and solve. Like there's a lot of parallels, yet I'm hearing that like I'm like on vacation or like partying. It's like after all this time, I've told you what, and you've been on these trips, like, and you know that that's not the case. Like you still think this, and that's when I realized I need to verify that I'm on the same page as somebody. Just because I tell them something doesn't mean that I communicated it right and that they understand. So now I like verify now, and that's made my relationships a lot better.
Yeah, the busiest, just
taking notes,
just relating to that, you know, that story of that, you know, those few months that were just absolute hell. Like that was me last year because I had about 8 months of touring, and also at the same time, some people will know this who are listening if they follow me. I bought a house that within 3 months, the central air died, the basement flooded, the deck had to be ripped off the house, and then the thing caught fire.
It's like, I'm laughing.
Dude, I laugh. I laugh now.
It sounds like a comedy.
Dude, it's still going on. Yeah. It's still going on. The thing is a fucking lemon, dude. But literally, and this was all happening while I was on tour. So
National Lampoon, I get a Chris Kelly's house.
Right.
Well, the Benny Hill music was playing all the time, so it was pretty funny.
Seriously, I hear it in my head every time I go to that house. But like, so this was all happening while I was on tour. So like, we bought the house, and that was kind of its own nightmare, because anybody who is, has been buying real estate within the last couple of years knows that it's like a fucking nightmare. Like, interest rates are through the roof. Housing prices are just through the roof. Everything sucks. And so we, but like, we finally got the house and we were excited about it. I was like, yeah, it needs some updating, but the bones are great. And then I'm on tour and then I get the call that the basement has water in.
Well, the bones are not great.
And then, well, so here's where it started, right? Like, so the basement floods. So it's a fully finished basement. The remediators come out and they're like, yeah, we got to take out 2 feet of drywall. Like, fuck. And so then they take out that 2 feet of drywall and then they find other drywall behind it that also had water damage. So then now this becomes an issue with the people who sold us the house. And I think that's about as far as I may be able to legally say about that. So then we had, long story short, the basement then has to be taken down to concrete. And then they investigate why it flooded. And they're like, well, your yard's not graded properly. And what I like, and then like I said, we had to rip the deck off the back of the house. I get home from, it was a US tour. I had like 10 days home. And what I assumed those 10 days were going to be was I'm going to have some of my friends come up to the house with some sledgehammers and some beer and we'll just demo the basement, you know? Because I'm not
going to. Oh, God, I would have loved that.
I know, dude. I was actually looking forward to it.
I would have shot that. I would have brought a gun if you wanted to shoot the walls down.
Because I was like, you know, at that point, like, I'm not paying the remediators, you know, to pull everything out of it. It's got to go down to concrete, so I'll just fucking destroy it. Day three, a bathroom fan shorted out and set the ceiling on fire.
House was not going to let you, interfere with its plans.
Yeah, and so we go running out of the house with the kids and the dogs, and as we're running out of the house, the guys who were coming to repair the central air that had broken a couple months earlier were pulling in the driveway and they're like, there's smoke coming out of your roof. And we're like, yeah, we know. Call 911, please. You know, like, dude, fucking like insane. So, but all this to say, like, bringing it back around, the people who, you know, see your Instagram feed or know what you do for a living and they're just like, oh, it must be so great that you're out there doing all this stuff. And it's just like, well, I've been to Japan and LA and Germany within the last 3 weeks, and all within that time, like, also my entire life has fallen apart. You know what I mean? So, like, it's not like, yeah, the shows might be cool.
It is important to say, though, it is awesome. Like, it is.
You know what I mean?
It's any life situation that anybody's going to be in, there is always room for difficulty, regardless of whether, you know, you're a Stepford wife or anything. And, you know, in the past few years, I've been able to find some, but I will say, I think the last tour that I did was the most fun that I had in a really, really, really long time. And it required a schedule. It required, you know, the help of a behavioral psychologist, and it just required doing things that helped improve it, that were personal choices that took time. And I think what, and this conversation comes down to how much, when people say something like, you know, we're going back to the mantra of make time for yourself. Some people don't have time, you know, like when you think about a person who has to work somewhere where there's a commute time, there's the required hours, then there's the extra time that they're just sort of like bullied into spending at the place just because it's like, hey, we got to do this stuff. You can't go yet. You go, okay, I'll stay here longer. Then there's a commute back. Then there's the need to feed yourself, maybe people in your family, anything else. There is need for upkeep, for, you know, bills, administrative stuff, everything.
What?
And then you got to go to bed. And some people just really don't have time to feel better. And that's the one thing that really does that I think is like that lifestyle creep of being able to recognize where you're like, I think my shit's getting too complicated because I can't find 2 hours to do all the things that are going to be necessary for me to sustain happiness through, you know, any type of, you know, whatever situation that I'm in. And that's the one thing that I really had to start carving out, was just making sure that I was going to find that time and it was non-negotiable.
So yeah, the 2 hours, it's like meditation, exercise, like
yeah, whatever.
That kind of, yeah, like whatever yeah. it is, but like doing those things that everyone knows they should do in order to not get depressed or not lose their minds.
What basically. I had to do was I had to start front loading it before work, where it's just like, because I always want to get to work. It's like, oh shit, I have to stretch, otherwise I can't start work. And that was really necessary for me because I always have this wishful thinking, be like, I'll just get this done, get done by 10 p.m. I'll have a couple hours to kick it. That I was saying that for years. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've been trying that because I've been like, I decided to just start working out again, even if I was injured. And it's been going great. Fucking awesome. However, I've been trying the whole like, I'll do it after.
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
just
yeah.
going to the gym at like 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. Once I did it at 1 a.m. And what
you're getting
I realized
hit, you're getting
is
hit on a lot,
I like that nobody's there. And I like that. I like that it's just me or a couple other weirdos.
Yeah.
That's cool. When you go at 1 a.m. and you're there till like 3, that's when the really weird crowd shows up. Like whoever goes to an all-night gym at like 3 a.m., that's there's some interesting motherfuckers that show up at that time.
It's just like going to Walmart at 3 a.m.
But what I'm realizing is that by going at that time, it fucks up my sleep.
Yeah.
And it's not a good thing. And I also want to just get right to work. And the last thing I want to do is start working out first thing in the morning. But if I don't, I'm setting myself up for a problem because then if I go at like 10 or 11, I'll get back by like midnight or 1, and then I have to like come down and like relax and still need like 2 hours to be able to sleep. And then it's like 4, and then I'm not getting up early.
Yeah, no.
And then it's not good.
That 3 a.m. Treadmill, that's a bad one.
Oh yeah, it's really
bad. It's a
bad
treadmill.
Nothing good happens.
No.
I had to start doing like prison workouts instead of going to gyms because I'm now going to Asia so much that in Japan specifically, most of the public gyms there don't allow you in if you have tattoos.
That's correct.
And so
really?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, well, for such a long time, the only people in Japan who had tattoos were the mafia.
Interesting.
This is a real thing.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So yeah, like if you want to go to like a spa or a bathhouse, which I don't know why you'd go to one of those, but
I can think of a few reasons.
yeah, I guess. But yeah.
I'm just thinking about how nice it sounded.
Basically any, call it, I don't want to say luxury, but like doing something for yourself. Going to the gym, going to a spa, going to a sauna, going to whatever, like that kind of stuff. Like if you have tattoos, a lot of the time it's like
my parents tried so hard to talk me out of them, and that's all they would have needed to have told me. Be like, you won't be able to go to a hot tub in Japan. And I'd be like, fuck.
Yeah.
This is true even in hotel gyms and hotel spas.
Yeah. They're loosening up on it a little bit now. As it becomes a little bit more like tattoo shops are starting to pop up around, like legit tattoo shops are starting to pop up around like Tokyo and stuff. So it's not quite as taboo as the younger generation begins to take hold, but it's still very much a thing. And so, and a lot of hotels just don't have gyms there. And so like, I just had to start, so if you've ever been you've been in a hotel in Japan, also, you know how small those rooms can get, like just having to take the little hallway that is both your entrance and your bathroom to just do push-ups and stuff in the morning. Like that's what I've been having to do. Literally feels like one of those scenes where the guy's just in a cell.
I love going to European gyms. I remember you first.
Oh, I was just going to say like body weight exercises are great. You can do everything you need to do pretty much almost.
Yeah.
With body weight almost.
Yeah.
But what are you saying? You love what?
I love foreign gyms. And I just remember I was in one in Germany at this hotel, which actually was another funny story from that one. There was like the AC was broken in the floor that my whole entire tour was in. And it was like 82 degrees.
Did they had AC first place?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like AC that could break. I mean,
yeah, in Europe. Pretty
nice. That's crazy.
But no, so I went down to the gym and I just remember working out. And then this guy came in, who's massive. And he, you know, he was definitely European. And he just, you know, set his Bluetooth speaker down. And it wasn't Venga Boys, but it might as well have been. He played like the most boisterous, like 90s, like Euro techno. And he just was like, he was just getting it. And it was like, the music was so loud that I took a phone call from my mom and I had to leave the gym because it was just so like, he was just like, it was full volume. And I just really like,
I admire the concept.
I liked it. Yeah. I liked it. It was a fun time, but I just remember that night I drank both my water bottles that were complimentary with the room. And, because I was at the gym, a bunch of people came down and they managed to get standing fans for the rooms. But by the time I was aware of the situation, I went to the front desk. There were no standing fans left. So I asked if I could get another bottle of water. And I remember the guy explaining to me that I already had water. And I was like, no, there's a little bit of a language barrier. We're like, I know it's gone. I drank it.
I need more of this very renewable resource, please.
And not possible. Yeah, it was like there was this like circular argument where I was like, I'd like more. And then he was like, we gave you two. I was like, I know. Dude, I drank two. And
this in
like,
Germany?
Yeah.
Yeah, of fucking course.
Not possible.
Yeah, he was just like, well, no. I was like, then I want a standing fan. He was like, well, no, then we don't have any. I was like, then I want water. Dude. And then after like four repetitions of this, I remember he like reluctantly gave me another two bottles and then he let me know not to drink both of them. I was like, I'll make that decision.
Yeah. These are mine now, motherfucker.
Yeah. Yeah, don't drink both of them tonight, then you won't have any tomorrow.
That sounds very
you telling me how
Europe.
Bottles work?
Yeah.
Oh fuck, dude. I was
like the first time I was like, I miss America.
Dude, I'll
just give you water.
It's not just because of being there more now. Even like the very first time going there, I have a way easier time getting around in Tokyo where nobody speaks a lick of English than I do in Germany.
Really?
Those conversations with people enrage me. Like, when you ask, like, somebody at a hotel desk who is supposed to be the person who's, like, able to facilitate things. Not complicated things, but just, like, I would like a bottle of water. Okay, here you go. Like, that's, like, kind of their only job. Apart from, like, welcome to the hotel, what's your name, here's your key. And when you just go and ask for something or like you ask for some kind of information or whatever, and they just in Germany, they always just give you this answer that makes you feel like a moron every time. Like,
do you guys want to hear about the time that I ate eyeballs?
I was there.
Yeah.
In Mexico City.
Yeah. That's funny about that.
In Mexico City, you said?
Yeah. Yeah. Did we talk about this?
I don't remember, but
so
I mean, I believe you.
So I went to. Now, this hotel desk, they would have given you any of the agua you wanted. You know what I mean? Like, they were cool. But
you might not want to drink the agua they give you, though.
As long as it's bottled and sealed.
I'll drink.
Okay. All right. Bottled and sealed. All right. Go.
I'm there to experience the place, you know? So when we went down to Mexico City, I was really excited because Mexico was it was a bucket list item, you know? And I went out to dinner with Spencer, his girlfriend. We had a great time. But I remember feeling like we were at a restaurant that was like, I was like, you know, this place is for Americans and they're making American food. Like they had, you could get salsa and chips, but it was basically a steakhouse.
You wanted the authentic.
Yeah. Well, I'm big on like going to eat at bodegas and shit like that. So like the next day I was like, I'm not going to fuck this up again. So I went to the desk. I was like, hey, where's the real shit? You know,
you learned what the actual authentic shit is.
Well, I could speak enough Spanish that like someone will appreciate the effort, but they know I'm struggling.
Enough Spanish to also use sign language.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know, I'm just like, you know, like comida auténtica, you know, donde, so when I got directed to this place and then I needed cash, that's a whole other hour long story. But I got back and I got the money, which honestly, being in Mexico, they you get so many $20 bills and they're not worth nearly as much in America. So you just feel like you're fucking Bill Gates the whole time because you're just throwing like a handful of 20s at everything.
If I have cash of any kind, it might as well be fake money.
Yeah, no, but you
means nothing to me.
So I go to this taco place and I'm literally the only person there. I am the only guy there, and I'm looking through the menu and I'm realizing that all of the tacos, your only options are pieces of an ox's head. And I remember there's a moment where I was like, oh, I don't know about this, but I'm the only person there. And this guy is stoked that I'm there. So I'm trying to pick what three tacos I'm going to eat. And I know how to say, you know, I'm like, well, tongue will probably be okay. You know, I know how to say like lip. So I'm like, all right. And he keeps pointing out ojo to me. And he's like, you know, give me the indicator. Like, you want this? Like, oh, yeah. And I'm just like, you know what? Fuck it. You know,
I want the ojo.
Because I'm gonna be on Riff Hard three times and I'm gonna start running out of shit. So I'm like, so I get it. And this guy watches me eat it like he's fucking Joe Rogan, and I'm like, I'm fucking Fear Factor.
Just what
you know? Because I'm the only person there, so he's just fucking sitting, pointed towards me, thumbs up, just like, how is it? And I'm eating eyeballs in a taco, and there is nothing surprising about it. There's nothing surprising about the texture. There's nothing surprising.
Is it like squeaky?
Did it pop?
No, they don't pop. No, they were like, there was still a toughness to it, but it was like they were meat, but there was still an aspect of them that was like slightly gelatinous, and I don't want to talk about it anymore.
I have always imagined that if you ate an eye, you bit into it, it would pop.
No, and it's like, I think about it like it's got to be like a low quality mushroom where it has that like squeakiness to it, like biting into a piece of rubber.
But did it have like a beefy kind of taste like a mushroom in your?
It, you know, I was kind of disassociating a little bit, but because I'm just like, there was a moment I thought I was gonna vomit just on the table, but I'm just like, yeah, I'll get thumbs up, you know. And I remember leaving and being like, fuck, I gotta get this shit out of my mouth. So I ended up, there's like these awesome, you know, you walk through Mexico City and there's just food stand after food stand after food stand of I should have eaten here by listening to the hotel. And then I go to a juice place and I'm looking through the juice options and I'm not
also pieces of an ox.
Yeah. So like I'm there and then I park at Pina. Because I'm like, oh, I think that's got to be like coconut, you know,
pineapple.
What I mean? Because I'm thinking, it was pineapple. So then I'm drinking straight up pineapple, which isn't any better. I'm like, God damn it.
Pineapple juice isn't any better than an ox.
I wasn't loving the pineapple juice, but I didn't drink it.
I was going to say, what happened to that pineapple juice?
I would argue pineapple juice is objectively.
Okay.
I'm with Chris.
This one just wasn't what I wanted. But it was fine. And then I remember getting street corn and being like, all right, I'm going to get street corn now. And I got to say,
there's a lot of small.
I didn't like the street corn very much. But later that day, I got some of the best tacos I ever had in my life. So it's okay. There was a difficulty curve to it. And I appreciate that difficulty curve.
I also have a story about Mexico City. Hey, y'all, I may have told you this before. For obvious reasons, I will not name the person. But suffice to say, they are a very prominent figure in the musical and metal community.
Oh no.
For two reasons, and meaning they've had two different careers and have been very successful at both.
Yeah, they were just really pissed off that nobody hotel spoke English.
Well, I don't even know if it was anger, dude. I don't know. We were at the hotel bar after the show that we played in Mexico City, and this person who the people that he was associated with, we had been working with a lot that year. I'm trying to be as vague as possible. Uh-huh. So he'd been around quite a bit, but we had never been introduced. I'm positive he did not know my name. And we hadn't spoken a single word to each other, just been in the same building a lot. Stark's mad.
Yeah, Ricky's dog already.
Yeah. Like, I don't like where this story
is. Yeah. Stark's is like, yeah, they're going to have to edit this out.
So this person who has had a lot of experience traveling, like 100%. This cannot be the first time this person was in Mexico. We're at the hotel bar after the show, and he makes a beeline for our table. Walks right up to us and goes, "This place is pretty fucking weird, man." And we're like, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "Well, you know, like back in LA, like they speak Mexican, but they speak American too. And like here, they're just speaking Mexican." And so I'm
was
thinking,
he trolling?
So that's my first thought, right? Like this is a bit that just isn't landing. He's like, mm-hmm. So we didn't say anything. I just stared at him. Like I just had prolonged eye contact.
My booking agent told me not to have this conversation.
And I just stared. Like I had no response because I was expecting him to be like, you know, like, but he just never did. Like I just went.
I actually had
that. And he was like, and just left. He clearly regretted saying that, and he just left the room. And to this, you have no idea how badly I want to tell the world who this was. Like, it is unbelievable.
He had to be trolling. To he had to be, and then just not, and then realized the joke wasn't funny, and
yeah,
then
yeah,
got
yeah.
embarrassed.
He like played it back in his head afterwards. Is like, you know what?
I'm gonna leave.
Yeah. I gotta get the fuck out of here.
I had that moment recently. I was asked to speak at something, and it was at a show, and there were just people waiting to watch a band, and I was asked to speak on something. Like,
please tell me that's how you started your show. You ever notice everyone speaking Mexican?
No. I just went up on a stage and I was talking, and people were just waiting for a band to play, and I was supposed to speak for 10 minutes. And I think I was maybe 45 seconds in. I was like, "And that's all we're doing today." And I just handed somebody a microphone and I walked out of the building. I didn't say anything to anybody. And then I just got in my car and I went back home.
Yeah.
And I was just like, and I wiped it completely clean.
Blank out, or like the words coming out of your mouth were like not, they were like,
well, no, I just realized that the audience just had no desire to listen to somebody talk. You know what I mean? And yeah. I was just like, you know, I'm the guy that's ruining everybody's time, right?
I have the power to end this.
Yeah, and I could just leave and pretend none of this ever happened.
Yeah, I mean, I back it. I back your move because I'm not afraid of public speaking, but I don't want to get up in front of a crowd waiting for a show and giving them a 10-minute monologue when that's not what they're there for.
Try getting up and playing a show to a room full of people that weren't told there would be a show. I had that happen once.
When?
With Galactic.
I've heard about this.
What happened?
We played, okay, so near the end of my time in Galactic Empire, we had management that, suffice to say, was unsatisfactory. And they had basically just, from what I understand, had just kind of taken over the booking in the way that our very capable booking agent was basically told to not even send offers through unless they were some absurd amount. And so we had no, like, for all I know, we'd gotten 1,000 tour offers and never heard about any of them. But anyway, we were told that we were going to go play at this quote-unquote Comic-Con, that's what they called it, in Ocean City, New Jersey. And for anybody who's ever been to the Ocean City Boardwalk, there's one like pier that juts out of the boardwalk, and it has a building on this pier. That's the entire pier is this building. And I had never been inside of it until that day. That's where the convention was being held. It was not a convention center. It was basically the size of a small, like an elementary school auditorium, full of windows. Like large windows, broad daylight. There's no covering this up, and we're going in there setting up, and it's not a convention. It's a bunch of local art vendors that just have their tables set up in there. And
surprise, it's a metal show.
Yeah, clearly none of them had been told that there was going to be a show.
Oh God,
they were visibly not happy. We, if you could imagine, were even less happy because not only were we realizing what a mistake this was,
dressed up as legally safe version of Star Wars,
yeah, grocery store off wear and Star Wars
wearing a robe,
yeah, and setting up these fucking lights. There were the space that was provided for the audience was a single row of white plastic picnic chairs right in front of the stage. And we were obligated to perform three sets that day.
Oh, God.
It was excruciating.
That just sounds embarrassing.
And if anybody can get me the video of this shit.
Oh, dude, I can't believe I didn't quit that day.
I need to do commentary on it.
Was it during the day, like outdoors?
Yeah. It was
so cool.
It wasn't outdoors. It was inside, but there were so many windows that it was like being outside.
Even better.
Broad daylight. And our first set was at like 11 a.m.
Amazing.
It was horrifying. And
dressing up as Star Wars at 11 a.m.
I won't go into too much detail out of respect, but I do have to add that one of my bandmates asked a fairly prominent actor from the Star Trek series if they would be the person that volunteered to be force choked during our set. And this was after our first two wildly unsuccessful sets.
Yeah,
and this person was just passing us in the green room and just trying to be nice.
Yeah.
Just like, have a good show, fellas. You know, keep on keeping on, basically. Like, don't kill yourself. That was essentially
don't do that again.
Yeah, right. Like, just trying to be, you know, from one performer to another, you know, just trying to be nice. And he should have been allowed to leave is what should have happened. But instead, the question was posed for him to come on stage with us. He said no, as he rightfully should have. And as he fully, while this was happening, I was basically in another room, nearly in the fetal position. Like, the secondhand embarrassment was crippling.
Well, yeah, but the thing about it is you're dressed up like a funny cartoon character.
Not at that moment.
So you should just be embarrassed for him.
Oh, man.
I'll tell you, man. We've been having actors come up on stage and do roles sometimes, and they're always awesome. They're always like, they're always like so excited to be there, and they're always having so much fun. And you always assume,
because you guys play shows that are, you know, intended.
Well, it prompts us. But you always assume that actors would. I grew up watching TV and movies, so you know, like I think like an actor, it's like that's like the top of the entertainment chain. But when you get a chance to actually hang out with them, they always think that musicians are doing something really cool.
Yeah.
And I'm always so surprised to find that out, where it's like, wait, you think what I'm doing is cool?
Right.
And
you're a movie star.
I'm just pretending to do shit on camera. They're always great.
And you're like, yeah, me too.
I love actors. They're always funny and charismatic.
So we're starting to like run out of time. We got to talk about guitar.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I'm going to like just stop all the momentum of all these great stories and ask some really boring questions.
All right. Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah, let's go.
Ready for me to tank the momentum of this podcast?
This is when everyone shuts it off and goes and turns on Rogan instead.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I mean, we can talk about some weird food some more. I went to a 5-star restaurant in Mexico City too, and Ant tacos were served to everybody. I didn't have
them.
Oh,
I bet those are good.
I eat those before I eat eyes.
All right, go. All right. So about guitar.
All right. What should people focus on, rhythm or lead?
Rhythm.
Rhythm.
Why?
Because it's the foundation of everything.
I personally, until I really actually got to the point where I could hear rhythm in my head and my hand was doing it, I feel like all the work I had done on my left hand was for naught. Personally, as I was starting to get more into playing some of the more difficult passages of the stuff that I have to do. And I think there's just something that's really important about being able to connect the actual transient attack moment of the pick hitting the string mentally, like feeling that, like if you're going like whatever it is, having that so concrete that and your left hand just follows along and recreates what your right hand is doing. Like I used to kind of use my left hand as that was like the template for everything I was doing. I'd try to make my right hand keep up with it as it was moving around. And as I've shifted those two roles, I have felt so much better about my playing.
Personally. I think that's recipe for loosey goosey playing. I think there's probably a couple exceptions out there. But I think overall, if you do that, your timing is going to be sacrificed.
Yes, big time.
Yeah,
big timing.
This might be a strange way to put this, but I think a good measure of whether or not you're ready to start playing fast and complicated left hand work is you need to go listen to the theme song of Friends. And if you can't do when they do it in the song, you're not ready. You gotta get that in.
I'm gonna go check.
I know people who can't do it, man. They sit there like they're trying to catch a fucking fish. And
isn't that weird? Isn't it weird when you see people clapping along in a crowd and
clapping on the one?
Oh, yeah, it's so weird.
But you know, and they're having fun.
It's always the fuzzy dude. You can't. Yeah, you have no idea how many times watching. I get on the talkback like white people.
It's really strange though. Actually, white? You know, like. I don't know what you said, but I'm sure it's awesome.
I said white people.
Oh, the clapping things or like rhythmically tapping on your legs or whatever helped me learn how to play way more complex patterns or strange groupings like quintuplets or something. Like that's how I learned to do it, was not on the guitar, was on my leg. And then once I could do that, or like just like on a desk or something, once I could do that, then it was easier to translate it to guitar. But then I also realized that once I could do that, translating it to the left hand was just very organic, as opposed to when I try to do strange subdivisions with just my left hand. Like if you try to go from like, I don't know, even not a strange one, like just 16ths to 16th note triplets with just your legato,
it's tough.
It's going to be a lot weirder if you can't do that well with your right hand.
I think the only thing that I could say that I came into music with an inclination towards was rhythm. And I think it really has to do with the sheer number of video games I played growing up, because I come from the Sega Genesis Super Nintendo era where like there were a lot of those games involved, you know, platforming, jumping from thing to thing, which actually required having a sense of like, you know, getting the timing right on stuff. And I read an article about that one time that was saying that, you know, they were finding that a lot of kids who had played a lot of video games growing up were able to learn about rhythm a lot quicker than, you know, kids who hadn't. And, you know, I don't know if it is a conclusive study or anything like that, but I believed it. But then when it came to anything melodic or harmonic, like stacking notes together or the concept of melody, you know, those maybe took like 20 years.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Okay, yeah. Next. How can you write better songs?
That's actually a good question.
Thanks, because the other ones sucked.
Yeah, learning.
All the other ones sucked. Actually got a good one in.
So personally, for me, one thing that really cracked things open a lot was learning a lot more about orchestration. Even if you're not planning on using an orchestra, understanding how an orchestra is put together or like just in a compositional sense can really actually break a song down into several things. I remember the first riff hard we were doing, we were talking about this, but breaking the song down into like a bunch of tiers of what it is. And so for me, in orchestra, you're going to have your leads. You're going to have your harmonic content, which is like your chords and what everything sums together. You have counter leads or counter melody. So you have melody, harmony, counter melody. Then you have rhythm, which these things all have overlap. You know, they're all Venn diagrams that have overlap with one another. And then the fifth thing you have is texture. And anything you're working on has to fall under one of those five categories. And being able to actually identify when you've already filled that category and you find yourself going back and trying to add to that exact same category and being able to ask yourself why is really important. And it's something that I think you don't really get into exactly through all of the channels of being a metal musician, you know, per se, because how a lot of us make music in when we're doing that is we're sitting there with a guitar, we're programmed drums, and we're using the guitar for several of those categories. And sometimes they're coming and going from part to part. And we might not have a strong grasp on, you know, like, well, what exactly is my melody here? I have these three events. All of them are kind of partially that, but it's like, you know, they're chords. And then sometimes, you know, it goes up high, it goes back to the chord. and being able to actually sit down and listen to a part and say, if I was going to hum this part with my voice and say what the melody is, what does that sum up to? Then if I was going to say what the chord progression is, what does that sum up to? And these other notes here, are they supporting the melody? Are they supporting the chord progression? Why do I need these here? And then I think that's one of the most important things to
recognizing when everything has a purpose.
Yeah.
For me, like, it's just...
Sorry, go ahead.
For me, it was just like... I think it just comes from my like nature as a player and as a musician in general. I'm going to name drop two Riff Hard alumni here. But I remember your episode, one of your episodes with Wes, how he mentioned, you know, he said, I want to be an orator, not a reciter. I am so very much a reciter. And I think that's just because of how I came up. I was in a music program where I was doing covers all the time. And like, even when I'm writing the music, like I write it, I put it together, I do whatever I have to do to make it sound the way that I want to. And then I have to learn it later. Right. And then recite that. But so for me, learning to get better at songwriting was very much just taking notes from other people. And the second person that I'm going to name drop was Dean from Arcspire, who I saw he posted somewhere. I think it was on YouTube, actually, like because they allow you to just post statuses now because they think that they're like that. He said something to the effect of, within the body of a larger post, every good idea I've ever had has started as a shitty ripoff of something else. And I identified really hard with that because I've had a very similar experience. There will be a song or a riff or something that I just can't get out of my head. And I wish I wrote that thing. And I wind up often kind of pursuing, how can I write that thing? You know, but inevitably, hopefully, inevitably, it starts to take on more of you than whatever it was that you were drawing off of, and then you can actually have your own identity as an artist and as a writer. But I think it all just comes down to trial and error too.
I think limiting your options.
That too. Like having a prompt.
I actually kind of had my own little personal renaissance in like the past year. And one of those things was I started only writing songs with my Ernie Ball Silhouette, which is a six string guitar that is down in drop E. I'm so frequently working on really low tuned music, and that thing plays mostly like a bass guitar, which I love the feeling of a bass guitar, but also I can, you know, play chords. I can do all my progressions on it. Stays in tune really well. There's so many reasons why it's just an automatically good sounding instrument whenever I need it. Even if I'm making a pop punk song and I'm doing everything on the third, playing power chords on the third string. But between that and my Prophet Rev 2, those are really those two things and a microphone. I try to limit my palette to those things when I'm writing, because it gives me sounds that I actively have in my head that I can kind of bounce around, rather than the prior thing that I was doing before, where I'm digging through samples,
flicking through presets,
digging around. Once I actually limited my choices, I could actually think about songwriting in a way where I had parameters I could work with, and yep. I could be creative with those parameters. I remember on my first song with Lois, Patrick Galati, and from Ice Nine Kills and Me, in the riff, I had actually punched the guitar a few times. You know, it's like da 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 da, and that just became a thing I'd do every now and then, where I'd be like, oh, you know, like, jun, 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 jun. And it was like I was finding all these ways to play around with this instrument. And obviously, when the song gets produced, we're going to use more than just these things. But for me, it just gave me an ability to write things and not go back and wonder, like, was this thing really cool just because I found an Omnisphere patch? You know what I mean?
Yeah, not letting yourself get tricked by the way something sounds.
Yeah.
Like, I think sometimes, look, I love low tunings and I'm like team 8 now. But even though I'm still team 6 and team 7, I've joined team 8 and I love it. But also, Dean told me something great, because when I got the 8, I asked him if he had any pointers. He said, treat it like a six. And that's kind of what I do. And I've noticed that a lot of people hide behind how cool it sounds that low, and they get tricked by like how good it feels to play opens on that low string and just undistorted. It just sounds so cool that you can trick yourself into thinking something is better than it actually is. And so I think it is important to take any sort of sounds out of the equation that are going to trick you. On the other hand, sometimes you want it to sound good enough to not be uninspiring, I guess.
Yeah. Because
if it sounds really bad, it's hard to... you're going to be distracted by how shitty it sounds.
Incapable.
There's like this balance. I've got a template. The template is limited. Like, I'm not going to add more things to it, but it sounds good. Like, it sounds good enough for a demo to where, like, my imagination can take it the rest of the way.
Yeah.
And there's enough options. There's, like, cleans, leads, like, some synth, like, drums to program. It's all there. And I don't ever really go outside of that when writing, so that I'm not worried about production or I'm not getting distracted. But also, it, like I said, it sounds good enough to where I'm not distracted by how bad it sounds or how off it sounds. Like, you can tell that what it's going to be, I guess.
Yeah. You know, one thing that is to be said about the template thing, and I think it's having a template that allows for enough expression is important, and I think it takes a long time to figure out what that is. I've had a couple people in my life that I've seen them get kind of stuck in a rut because they have such a... Some sounds are a lot more agnostic than other sounds. Like, some sounds are a lot more open for interpretation with multiple genres, and some sounds are just going to force you into a whole... because they only apply to certain very specific genres, like certain drum samples, certain guitar tones, things like that. So I've had some friends, specifically with like a lot of the MIDI stuff, I've had some people in my life that I've watched them for years using the exact same sounds and pretty much getting the same result over and over and writing similar riffs, because those sounds don't have the breadth of expression that's going to let them get outside of those types of riffs and those types of things. So that's for me, I always have to ask myself that whenever I'm, you know, I'm big on just opening up a new session. I use Pro Tools, so I just import settings from like whatever my newest session was, and I'll have like a drum preset that gets brought over. You know, it gets used like 35 times before I finally get around to playing around with some knobs, and then that's going to get imported for the next year and a half or whatever. But I always have to ask myself, is this actually allowing for me to create different things, or is this just forcing me into a hole of making the same thing? Or is that familiarity good? Am I getting better at working with that familiarity or not? So I think it's like, it's good to always limit your options, but it's also good to, you know, really think critically on those options and ask, like, is it time that I get a different drum sound? Like, is it time that I try a different bass sound? Is it time I try that? And I think that's kind of like the type of thinking that lets me, you know, I work on a lot of different things at once. But I have to, you know, every now and then be like, you know, I think I'm going to stop using this guitar tone, because it's really driving me to use this one articulation a lot. And now I'm like painting myself into a corner.
Yep.
I think it's also
makes sense.
I think it's also important to just not to not be like afraid of whatever might come out when you're just throwing darts at the wall, essentially. Like, when you're writing a thing. Like, I actually have a big problem. Like, I'm virtually incapable of demoing something out without trying to make it the final product. Like, pretty much everything in this body of work that Hillhaven's going to be putting out is like a mixed version of like what I put together that day, because I just have this like obsession with, like, I have the sound in my head and I don't want to just throw down a placeholder. Like, I want it to be what it's going to be, but that can wind up being a kind of a crippling thing where, like, you have an idea of something that you haven't done before. You got inspired by a certain song or a certain sound or whatever, and you want to try to do kind of your own version of that. And you're trying it for a few minutes and it's just not going well, and you abandon it. You know what I mean? Because you're just like, this isn't working. I don't know why, but I'm getting frustrated, and like it like makes you doubt yourself when the thing that you're trying isn't working the way that you would have hoped. And I think it's important to do your best to not be so averse to those moments, because like sometimes there's a little bit of a learning curve with stuff, and if you just kind of fight through it a little bit, you might actually wind up, it might not be what you like, where you thought you were going to end up, but you might wind up, like, you know, adding another skill to your bag of tricks, you know what I mean, another thing that you can draw from in the future.
Yeah, you can't be afraid to suck. All right, last question. What's the first song you ever learned?
I think my first
one, Iron Man.
I think my first one was the riff from a song called Easy Target by Blink-182.
Oh, shit, really? Iron Man. I was at my friend Adrian Pantanella's house, and she let me play her bass guitar. And she's like, here's how you play Iron Man. And I just remember sitting there and tuning a couple times, one finger.
I spoke to Harold from Eminence earlier today.
We did a podcast, and he said one finger Iron Man was his first song. Yeah.
That might have been, I think a lot of us watched the movie School of Rock, and I think that was one of the first things that he, like, that Jack played very simply to like test the kid's ability in the movie. So that might have been one of the first ones that I played. I wanted to play the song that Lindsay Lohan mimed in Freaky Friday, but I didn't know how to figure that out at the time. So I had to make do with the other thing.
How about you?
Fade to Black.
Nice.
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 That's a kind of a tough one.
Is it?
To be the first one. To be the first song you learn how to play?
It is. It's the first song I learned. Didn't say I played it well, but...
Sure, but like that's, I don't know, like that's that, I find that impressive.
It was a...
It's not a single note thing.
It took a while. Well, the thing is, the guitar teacher I had, it wasn't the first thing I learned. It was the first song I learned.
Like, full song, so, yeah.
I had played classical guitar for, like, 6 months before that and fucking hated it. Hated it. And it was because my parents wouldn't buy me an electric guitar unless I did this. I think they just didn't want me to play electric. So it was like this, if you do this for 6 months, then we'll get you an electric, when I was, like, 13. So I did it, but I fucking hated everything with classical. So by the time I got the electric teacher, it wasn't like the first time I ever played. I was still a beginner. It took a little while to learn, but it was cool. It felt like I felt good about learning it.
Dude, I remember learning that song, like how stoked I was to get that acoustic chord progression down. That was such a cool little melody that they had in there. Like, I was obsessed with that song for a really long time. So yeah, I relate to that.
And they used inverted power chords in it. I learned inverted power chords from the beginning. Like, I was thinking about that. I was thinking how that's not a first song for a lot of people, but like, there's so much in that song. There's like clean parts, there's inverted power chords, there's interesting like harmonic stuff going on. There's non-solo melodies, like there's like all kinds of stuff, so it's like a
all
good
five
first
categories
song.
All five category.
What's that?
I said all five categories.
It's true.
Yeah,
it's true.
God, all those Metallica songs, I had to learn as many of them as I could when I was little.
They're great.
Oh, they're so,
there's a reason they are who they are.
Yeah,
for sure.
All right, dudes, I think is a good place to end it. Anything else you want to say about The Hill Haven?
Check it out.
Yeah, check it out. I don't know when this episode's going to be coming out, but it's
really, really
be...
soon. Right now, okay. So for people listening or watching, it's April 5th, 2024.
Okay. Yeah, we launched the band on the 12th.
I thought it was the 8th.
We do the teaser on the 8th. I'm going to have to make sure everybody knows that, because now I'm nervous. The teaser is on the 8th, but the official reveal is on the 12th, and then the first song is out on the 19th. So, regardless of when this comes out, please take a look. Hill Haven, one word, spelled exactly how it sounds. We would really appreciate it.
Not Hell Haven.
Not Hellhaven. Sorry.
Even though I like it.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
Yeah,
anytime. Appreciate it, man.
And thanks for redoing the episode, because
of course,
people who don't know, this is a redo. All right, see you guys later.
All right, peace out.
See you, buddy.